Welcome to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. And now your hosts, Tim Cole and Jeff Lewis.
Welcome, everyone. I am Jeff Lewis.
And I'm Tim Cole. Both Jeff and I are certified appellate specialists, and as uncertified podcast hosts, we try to bring our audience of trial and appellate attorneys some legal news and perspectives they can use in their practice. As always, if you find this podcast useful, please recommend it to a colleague.
Right. If you find it unhelpful, go ahead and send it to your opposing counsel.
All right, Jeff, let's get right into it. We're going to spend this episode giving our top 10 appellate tips to family law attorneys. So a lot of the trial attorneys that we work with are family law attorneys, and they have special considerations. Some are the same considerations that apply to all appeals. Some are special, but we wanted to make this top 10 list specifically tailored to family law attorneys. What do you say, Jeff?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. All right, let's just get right into the top 10 list. We're going to start at number 10. And Jeff, the ranking here is purely for dramatic purposes. This okay. might be the most important tip that we start with, but for dramatic purposes, we're going to ramp up to number one. So the number 10 tip is learn to spot appealable orders. As we know, Jeff, we've talked about this. If an order is appealable immediately, it has to be appealed immediately. You can't put it in your back pocket and wait till later. So appeal it now or waive it forever. So some common family law orders that are immediately appealable include support orders, either temporary or final support orders, attorney fee orders, orders denying support, property division orders, pendente light sale orders, bifurcated orders like marital status, interim or temporary rulings if they're certified for appeal, post-judgment rulings such as modifications, and child dependency orders.
Yeah, and a big type of modification post-judgment are move-away orders, orders either granting or denying one parent the right to move out of state with a child. Those are technically appealable, but given the time exigency and the issues of kids growing up while the courts wind their way through the system, I always suggest a writ in addition to an appeal.
Yeah, that's a great point of advice, Jeff, because there are some orders that are immediately appealable, but you also want to consider, you know, by the time I get this resolved on appeal in 18 months or 24 months or longer, is there going to be anything left, any remedy left for me at the end of this road? So yeah, you may need to think about jumping the line with a writ petition if it's truly warranted.
Right.
And then just a couple, just by way of juxtaposition, some non-appealable family law orders would include temporary custody orders and other bifurcated issues like enforceability of a premarital agreement. And then, of course, if the appealability is unclear, then you may want to do what you talked about, Jeff, with a move-away order. File the direct appeal, but also file a writ petition, just in case the Court of Appeal disagrees with you on the point of appealability.
Absolutely.
And then the same principle applies to, you know, when you said move away orders, Jeff, any other order that involves public importance or the need for prompt resolution, consider bringing that as on a writ basis, because again, at the end of the process on an appeal, who knows if there is going to be any useful remedy that the court can give you.
Right.
Okay. Number nine, calculate the appeal deadline correctly. And Jeff, this can be harder than it looks. We've talked about multiple cases on this podcast where things have gone a little bit haywire or not as expected. The best rule is to assume that your deadline to appeal is 60 days from the order. Even though the default deadline is really 180 days, there are a couple of sneaky ways that deadline can get shortened, and it often is shortened. And sometimes in ways that we don't expect, it can be shortened in multiple orders. It could be that one party serves a notice of entry, but then also the clerk will serve a file stamped copy of the order. And which one of those triggers, or both of them trigger the 60-day deadline? It's better just to be conservative with that deadline and assume it's 60 days from the order.
Yeah. Best practice is ignore the notice of entry part and just calendar 60 days from the date of the order. And that way you don't have to get hung up on whether or not this was sufficient to even count as notice or service of notice of entry of order.
Yep, that's right. That way you don't have to worry about it. If it's unclear, then you just default to 60 days from the date of entry. Right. Same thing with extension rules, Jeff, under Rule 8.108, where you file a post-trial motion, such as a motion for reconsideration or motion to set aside. You get 30 extra days from the date of the denial. But again, it gets complicated. You know, was that motion timely? If it's not timely, then it's void. You don't get the extension. Right. If the judge waits too long to decide it, then it's deemed denied sooner than you may have expected, and then you may have blown way past even the 30-day extended deadline. So better just to assume 60 days from the original order. What do you do, Jeff? Have you ever had a situation where you suggest to trial counsel just go ahead and file the notice of appeal now, so you're well within the 60 days? And trial counsel asks, but I'm filing a motion for a new trial. Won't the judge say that deem that it no longer has jurisdiction if you've already?
No, I got to say, in my position, trial lawyers really just say, okay, whatever you say. They don't usually question the appellate jurisdictional issues.
Yeah. There is a problem with that if there's on a motion for reconsideration. We've talked about that on the podcast, that an appeal does deprive the trial court of jurisdiction to reconsider orders once they're on appeal.
Right.
That's
On the subject of extensions, you know, trial lawyers love to live in the buffer of getting an extra 5 days for a mail service of order or 2 days of for email or overnight service. In our appellate world, those 5 day and 2 day extensions based on the mode of transmission don't really exist for any of our deadlines.
No, that's true. All these appellate deadlines and the extension deadlines, they're all deemed jurisdictional. So you don't get those service by mail extensions or service by electronic means extensions. Drop those from your calculus when you're calculating appeal deadlines and post-trial motion deadlines.
Right.
All right. Number 8 tip on our top 10 lists of tips for family law attorneys on appeal: preserve your challenges to evidentiary rulings. If there's key evidence that's been excluded, preserve that issue by making a proffer. Keep objecting to evidence if the court defers ruling on your motion in limine, and also be aware of any kind of sidebar discussions with the judge or in chambers discussions with the judge that don't get reported. Make sure that you get those back on the record one way or the other. Maybe next time you're in front of the court reporter, ask the judge if you can be permitted to recapitulate, to summarize your discussions for the benefit of the record. Make sure that anything important gets on the record.
Yeah, judges truly enjoy it when a trial lawyer on a losing end of an order says, "Oh, Your Honor, you mind if I just make my record?"
Well, your job as the trial attorney is not to be popular. Of course, on the other hand, you are there to be popular. You want the judge to like you and like your client and like your client's arguments and evidence. But you know, if you start, especially when you start to see things going south, then you've already lost the popularity contest. You might as well try to start improving your chances on appeal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, number 7. Here's a number 7 tip. This is about the statement of decision. And Jeff, this is probably the topic that I spend the most time on consulting with trial attorneys and family law attorneys, is the importance of the statement of decision. And it's often enigmatic. About why do I need a statement of decision? I already have the judge already explained the ruling. It's in this temporary decision or tentative decision. What does it matter? Well, without the formal statement of decision, then the Court of Appeal is still going to apply the doctrine of implied findings. It's basically, if you remember your constitutional law and the rational basis standard of review, where the court will imagine any valid reason that to support a law, even if it was the furthest thing from the legislature's mind, it's still part of the rational basis review. That's kind of like the implied findings review of factual findings. The Court of Appeal will imagine that the trial judge made any kind of factual finding that could arguably have been supported by anything in the record, even if it was the farthest thing from the trial judge's mind. So to defeat that doctrine of implied findings, you have to timely request a statement of decision, identify the principal controverted issues that were at your hearing or trial, and the findings that you propose the judge make on them. Then the judge is obliged to issue a proposed statement of decision, and that gives you your additional opportunity and requirement to object to any missing findings from that proposed statement of decision. And then and only then have you finally perfected the statement of decision and such that any omitted findings will not be implied or inferred on appeal under the doctrine of implied findings.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, this is a super important point, especially in family law, though. When I've come across records, I'm reviewing records for an appeal, sometimes I see requests for statement of decisions or objections to statement of decision that resemble interrogatories directed to the court, like contention interrogatories. State all facts upon which you base your judicial finding that blah, blah, blah. There's no appellate value to sending contention interrogatories to the court. You need to just identify missing issues and try to pin the court down on the principal issues, but don't send contention rogs.
That's right. Yeah. If you start to get in the mode, you start to get the same feeling in drafting your request for statement of decision that you do when you're drafting interrogatories, then you've gone astray. Think of it like the statement of decision stands in the same role as special verdicts. So imagine that you're drafting a special verdict form. That should be in the same vein as drafting your request for statement of decision.
Right.
Should be limited. I'd say if you go over, you know, what, a couple dozen separate disputed controverted issues, principal controverted issues, that's the standard under CCP 632, principal controverted issues. There should not be more than two dozen of those in a case.
Yeah, unless you're prosecuting the Apple antitrust case or something like that, you're too far into the weeds if you go beyond a dozen.
Yeah. And the deadline for that, for the requesting the statement of decision, follow the procedure outlined under Rule of Court 3.1590. The trial judge has to first issue a tentative decision. That's in cases and trials that last longer than a day. The court will issue a tentative decision, at which point you have 10 days to file your formal request for statement of decision. If the in short causes, then you need to request your statement of decision before the matter is submitted, either orally or, as Jeff and I have recommended, just file that request for statement of decision even before the trial begins.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. Let's get to number six. Tip number six, file a motion for new trial to preserve challenges to the damages amount. Now, as I was writing this, or as I'm reading it now, Jeff, I'm wondering, how often does this come up actually in family law appeals? Does the damages amount, is typically the money amount is an equalization or a sanction or a family law fee order? But do you ever see family law cases that that involve a damages award?
No, I haven't. I mean, I can imagine a circumstance where a judge finds that one party has violated fiduciary duties and harmed the marital estate, but I've never seen that expressed in terms of anything like damages.
Yeah, I will. Now that I'm curious about this, I'm going to go and take a look and see if there are money awards in family law matters that are deemed to fall under this rule. And the rule that we're talking about here is that when there is a dispute over the money award being excessive or inadequate, you have to raise that challenge in a motion for new trial before you bring it up on appeal. Because if you bring it up on an appeal for the first time, Court of Appeals is going to say, forget about it. You have to give this to the trial judge first. We don't want to be thinking about this in the first instance. And that even applies, Jeff, when it's after a bench trial. You would think that, well, maybe the jury was innumerate and just went overboard on the amount of damages. We need to give the judge a chance to fix it first before we send it up to the Court of Appeal. But this even applies after a bench trial, when presumably the trial judge has already thoughtfully analyzed the numbers before issuing the damages amount.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, we'll maybe before we release this, I'll go and double check this and put in the show notes whether this rule applies in family law appeals, such as to warrant a spot in our top 10 list for family law appeals. Okay, but now let's move on to tip number five. Consider getting a stay of enforcement of the judgment pending the appeal. The default rule, as we've talked about before, Jeff, under CCP 916, once you file the appeal, everything is stayed. Nothing can be enforced. But the broad network of exceptions to that rule effectively amounts to a complete opposite rule where nothing is stayed. The things that are stayed are things without a bond, that is, are mandatory injunctions like move-out orders, something that requires the appellant to do something, or interim rulings in marital cases where the court certifies and grants, the Court of Appeal grants a motion to appeal. But things that are definitely not stayed would be money judgments, fee orders, dissolution and legal separation orders, where the court retains jurisdiction to award community property or debts. For these things, you have to get a bond, or you file a petition for supersedeas in the Court of Appeal.
Right.
Okay. Number four, make sure when you've taken your appeal and you're writing your brief, get the standard of review right. There are three basic standards of review: de novo, which are great on for the appellant because there's no deference to the trial judge; abuse of discretion, where there's lots of deference given to the trial judge; and substantial evidence, where again, it's pretty much forget about challenging any factual findings made by the trial judge.
In that latter regard, if you have an appeal where your only issue is going to be substantial evidence review, you might consider counseling trial lawyer or client to see if this is a case where changed circumstances in 6 months might warrant some sort of motion for modification or reconsideration. And you might have better odds attacking this again at the trial court level than trying to raise a substantial evidence challenge on appeal.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. And then if you are going to challenge based on abuse of discretion, keep in mind the rule that a trial court's failure to exercise discretion is itself an abuse of discretion. And the kind of circumstances where that comes up is where there is a required factor or set of factors that the trial court is supposed to consider and the court doesn't consider them. Then that is a good issue to raise up under the abuse of discretion standard, because that effectively is treated like a misapplication of the law or failure to follow the law.
Right.
Okay. Tip number three, avoid common briefing mistakes. And Jeff, we've covered this before. Things like if you're the appellant, you have to, and especially if you're raising, if you're challenging the ruling for lack of substantial evidence, you have to cite all of the evidence and facts, certainly factual findings that support the judgment, including citations to the record. So it's very difficult when you are challenging for substantial evidence and you're really trying to focus on all the ways that the trial judge ignored all your great mountain of evidence. You have to put all that aside and go the counterintuitive route of first establishing all of the evidence that supports the judgment. If you don't do that, then your substantial evidence challenge will be waived. You have to put all your arguments under their own heading. That sounds really idiosyncratic, but we've seen issues be deemed waived or forfeited for that reason, because they were not captured under their own heading, so the Court of Appeal could easily find them. Citing appropriate case or legal authority to support all your points, that will lead to waiver or forfeiture for failing to do that.
Yeah, and you should cite real cases. Recently in the Ninth Circuit, a case got tossed due to a lawyer's perhaps use of ChatGPT to generate imaginary cases, and there's oral argument on that making the rounds on the internet. You can see the video of the oral argument where the judges from the Ninth Circuit ask this lawyer, what are these cases? And the attorney doesn't really answer the question.
Yeah. And that's a big deal. I think a lot of attorneys were very interested in that case. And I think it reflects badly on us as attorneys when we cite law that doesn't exist. It reflects poorly on the Court of Appeal system when the attorneys there are potentially losing what might be winnable issues because they're not citing appropriate authority.
Yeah, based on lawyering, bad lawyering.
Yeah, So don't do that. Make sure you are checking your authorities before you send them up, before you rely on them. And we talked about it. And then make sure you're getting the right standard of review. And again, Jeff, we talked about this in the case Mandir versus Tiwari, where appellant had a near $50,000 sanctions awarded against them for using the improper standard of review, for not including all of the relevant trial exhibits and other documents in the appendix in the appeal, and not including citations to the record. So missing one or more of these core appellate procedures in your briefs can have serious side effects, not least of which is losing your client's case.
Yeah.
Number two, advise your client about important post-judgment issues, such as make sure your client is aware if your appeal is unsuccessful, are they going to be exposed to more attorney's fees, the other side's appellate fees. Consider a bond, posting a bond to get a stay pending the appeal. And consider that there's going to be post-judgment interest accruing if there's a judgment against your client and they don't intend to pay it and instead wait to see how the appeal shakes out. They're going to be exposed to 10% additional interest per year.
Yeah, yeah. And let me add one more to this point number two. In the family law context especially, it's important that the party who's appealing, the appellant, obey any orders. And if they fail to obey any of the trial court's orders, I've seen respondents successfully raise the disentitlement doctrine and the appeals get tossed out of court. So it's important for appellate counsel to understand what post-judgment orders or what orders might be out there that need to be complied with, and is the client complying with them, and is there a potential disentitlement motion out there lurking?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. We're always looking out for disentitlement issues where appeals are dismissed under the disentitlement doctrine. Yeah, it typically it's there has to be multiple violations or multiple failures to comply with court orders, but you don't want to go down that road. You don't want to have to get in the position, even if you defeat a motion to dismiss for disentitlement, you're not looking too good in the court of appeal if you are having to explain why you're not complying with trial court orders.
Yeah.
Okay, Jeff, and our number one tip for family law attorneys is make a record. It's kind of an old trope for us appellate attorneys, but if we don't have a good record of what happened in the trial court, there's not a whole heck of a lot we can do on appeal. So some examples of mistakes in this regard and failing to make a record will be when the trial court may want to speed things along or have sidebars or chambers discussions. As we mentioned earlier, you still want to find a way to get those communications onto the record, or at least the upshot of those sidebar or chambers conferences. Get those onto the record somehow. Motion in limine rulings, again, sometimes they may happen in pre-trial. They might not be reported for some reason. That would be a big mistake. You want to get those reported. And then if, depending on what the ruling is, you have to keep objecting, get all your evidentiary objections on the record. And as for pre-trial conferences, sometimes those can lead to shaping the issues that get addressed, or whether you get to bring certain witnesses or bring your experts. If those are not reported for some reason, consider filing a status brief that summarizes the record. One of the first things I like to look at, Jeff, when I'm looking at an appeal to see what happened at trial, is I look at the trial briefs that were submitted before and trial briefs that were submitted after, or closing briefs. That gives you a real sense of how things started and how they're going.
Yeah, indeed. And on the subject of making a record, let me also add, oftentimes, especially in family law cases, people want to introduce evidence of voicemail messages or videos. You need a transcript. But sometimes trial judges or clerks don't always know to ask you to prepare a transcript. And if you don't have a transcript and you try to make that as part of the record on appeal, it is very difficult to argue that the contents of that voicemail message or video somehow is evidence that can be considered on appeal. So get a transcript made before your trial.
Yeah, yeah, good tip. Yeah, and as for getting the court reporter, they're getting harder and harder to get. Don't take them for granted. Over the past 5 years at Los Angeles County Superior Court, the court reporter workforce has dropped by a quarter. So and court reporter retirements continue to far outpace their replacement rate. So probate and family law departments for a long time still had guaranteed court reporters, but as of late 2022, they don't, at least in Los Angeles. So check the status of court reporters in your departments in your county, because you should not take it for granted that there's going to be a court reporter there.
Right.
Okay, Jeff, that wraps up our top 10 tips for family law attorney appeals.
Yeah, well, thanks for walking us through that. And if you have suggestions for our future episodes or a possible guest, please email us at info@calpodcast.com. In our upcoming episodes, look for tips on how to lay the groundwork for an appeal when preparing for trial.
See you next time.
You have just listened to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. For more information about the cases discussed in today's episode, our hosts, and other episodes, visit the California Appellate Law Podcast website at calpodcast.com. That's calpodcast.com. Thanks to Jonathan Caro for our intro music. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next time.